We're talking about guns and public health here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two mass shootings last weekend in a span of less than 24 hours, and that means in character with previous mass shootings here in the U.S., the debate over guns and gun violence comes front and center again. And in recent days, the American Medical Association and dozens of healthcare organizations have issued statements saying that gun violence is a major public health issue. Here is trauma surgeon Ronnie Stewart on CBS.
To go and talk to a mom of a child who was normal at breakfast and now is not here is the worst possible thing. And honestly, it drives us to address this problem.
How are you responding to the weekend's tragic events? What are you reflecting on? Do you consider gun violence a public health crisis or emergency? We're at 800-642-1234. David Hemenway is a professor of health policy at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and he's director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. He studies and writes about injury prevention, including gun violence and firearms. David, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, the American Medical Association is calling gun violence a public health crisis, and they've been doing this for years. Do we treat it as such?
More and more, fortunately, people are at least talking about using a public health approach to try to reduce this public health crisis. It's also a public safety crisis. But when over 100 people a day are being killed by guns, including suicides and homicides and gun accidents, that's a major public health problem, and it's not just the fact that people are dying and people becoming seriously injured. It's also that exposure to violence. Now the evidence is overwhelming that exposure to violence, if you're a victim, if you're a bystander, if you're a perpetrator, if you are just close by and read about it, can have long-run bad repercussions in terms of both mental health and physical health.
So how is our response to gun violence different from other public health emergencies?
Well, in most other public health emergencies, at least after a while, we start doing more things than we're doing here. Every other developed country, so every other high-income country, talking about 29 other countries, have done much more to try to reduce gun violence in their countries and have been incredibly successful. They have much stronger gun laws. They don't allow the types of guns which are so common in the United States. They make sure that it's much harder for the wrong kind of people to lay their hands on firearms. And so they don't have the problems to the extent that we have.
You've been researching gun violence for decades now. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention can't use any funding to advocate or promote gun control under a 1996 budget provision known as the Dickey Amendment. So how has this impacted gun violence research and the research that centers like yours can carry out?
Yeah, so most public health issues require good data and good research, and so that's how we learn so much about HIV, and it's how we learn so much about obesity and what to do and so forth. But in this area, there's been an incredibly small amount of good funding for research, so there's not been nearly enough research. There was a study done in, I think, the New England Journal or JAMA recently, which looked at the size of the problem and just in terms of death. One would have expected maybe something like 20 times more funding for research in this area and 10 to 20 times more journal articles trying to understand the problem and talking about reasonable ways to deal with the problem. And so there's so much we don't know because of lack of research funding, for example. Last year, we wrote, I think, the first article ever focused on gun theft, even though there have been something like 350,000 guns stolen each year, and it's one way guns get into the wrong hands. But we know almost nothing about what you would be interested in, which is things like the who, what, why, when, where, and how of gun theft. And so it's hard to figure out exactly what we should do and also to figure out if what we're doing is useful.
We're talking with David Hemenway. He's a Harvard Health policy professor looking at gun violence after two mass shootings over the weekend. Your thoughts, where would you like to see more public discussion around gun violence? What actions or policies or decisions do you want to see from government authorities? Should addressing gun violence and mass shootings be a priority for our country? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Duane now, joining us from Hayward. Hi, Duane.
Yeah, good morning. The problem isn't the guns and stressing an object over the act of violence is totally in generous with the problem. Violence is the problem, not the weapon use. Many more people are killed with hands and fists and other objects in the United States than are with guns. You need to stress the violence. Anytime you demonize a object, you're looking at the wrong thing here. You need to look at overall violence, why people are killing each other. It's not the weapon used. People are killed every year, getting run over by cars, getting hit in the head with a fist, and other objects all the time.
Well, let's see what David has to say about that. How do guns stack up in other ways about the ways other people are injured and killed?
Yeah. So in terms of violence, that's over 75% of homicides in the United States are with guns. Over half of suicides are with guns. And yes, there are other objects involved in other kinds of deaths, like motor vehicles. And one of the things to emphasize is that the public health approach is not about demonizing anything or about holding objects responsible. It's about figuring out ways which are the most cost-effective ways of preventing the problem. So, for example, in motor vehicles, when I was growing up, we had a huge, huge motor vehicle problem, four times worse than we have now or more. And everyone was saying, oh, it's the driver. It's the driver. It's not the car. It's the driver. And the notion was that, which is true, that virtually every motor vehicle accident is caused by some sort of driver error. And well over half of all motor vehicle deaths are caused by drivers who deliberately disobey the law, who are driving drunk, who are speeding, and so forth. And so initially the notion was, let's focus on the driver, the driver, the driver. And it wasn't until public health physicians began asking a different question, not who caused the accident, but what caused the injury. And it was that people were being speared by steering columns that didn't collapse. Their faces were lacerated by glass, which wasn't made of safety glass, on the windshields. They were thrown from the car, and their heads would hit the cement, and they would die. And public health physicians were saying, couldn't we make the cars safer? Couldn't we make the roads safer? Couldn't we make the EMS system better? And fast forward 60 years, cars are much, much safer than they were. We have airbags and seatbelts and collapsible steering columns and safety glass and on and on and on. And roads are much safer and the EMS system is better. And nobody really thinks the drivers are better. We're a little better about drunk driving. We're much worse about distracted driving. And yet motor vehicle fatalities have fallen between 85 to 90%. And a tremendous public health success story. And we can do the same things in firearms. If we just get out of this notion of let's figure out who to blame and just wash our hands, that it's somebody else's fault. We can all work together and figure out what could gun manufacturers do? What could gun retailers do? We've been working a lot with gun trainers who can do a lot of good trying to reduce the problem. Clergy can do a lot more. Foundations can do more. And government can do more, of course. But the government's not the only entity that can really help try to reduce this problem, which, again, is a uniquely American problem in terms of all the developed countries.
Talking with David Hemenway, who has approached his study of gun violence over the decades as a public health crisis. He's a health policy professor at Harvard School of Public Health, where he directs the Injury Control Research Center. Do you consider gun violence a public health crisis or emergency? Do you feel less safe with the rise of mass shootings? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about gun violence and public health in the wake of the mass shootings last weekend in El Paso and Dayton, where at least 31 people were killed, dozens injured. The backdrop is that there are more than 30,000 people killed by guns every year in our country. An additional 100,000 people are injured. How are you responding to the weekend's tragic events? What are you reflecting on here? Do you consider gun violence a public health crisis? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. David Hemenway is a professor of health policy at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and he stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with John joining us from Caledonia. Hi, John.
How are you guys this morning?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, just with the gun violence, I really think it's a lack of empathy that these shooters have for people. And from what I know, empathy or lack of empathy is a sign of mental illness. I mean, if you don't care to help people or if you want to hurt people, that is an issue. Okay. And I think the big thing is that there's history of these people's lives that have indicated this. And they, you know, people have to, you know, speak out or get them help or, you know, find some way to identify that these individuals need help and in some cases, you know, need to be treated for it.
John, thanks for the call. And as John said there, President Trump also called this a mental health issue yesterday. David, what do you think?
Well, most of these shooters really don't have at least designated mental health issues. They certainly probably have lack of empathy. And we should do as much as we can just in general, forgetting about gun violence, about people's mental health in the United States. We don't do a very good job. We don't do enough of a good job teaching and focusing on trying to rear kids who have more empathy and so forth. But in terms of reducing the gun violence problem in the United States, the most cost-effective way, clearly, is to do something about the guns. You have to realize that people in all the other developed countries, not just one or two or three or four or five, but all 29 other developed countries, it's not like the United States has less empathy. There's no evidence that we are less empathetic than people in other countries. It's no evidence that we have much more serious mental health problems than these people in other countries. But they have figured out a way to dramatically reduce the problem, and we haven't. And the only big difference is the way we treat guns and the way they treat guns. And it's also true when you look across states. The states, you know, comparing urban states to urban states and rural states to rural states, the states which do better in terms of stronger and more reasonable gun laws and have fewer gun owners per capita do much better, have typically fewer mass shootings. I mean, have no mass shootings, have fewer mass shootings, have fewer homicides, have fewer suicides. The evidence is overwhelming that a gun in the home increases the risk for suicide for everyone in the family.
So would endorsing red flag laws that would allow taking firearms from people found to be dangerous to themselves, would that be a step forward in your research?
So there's some evidence. There's not huge amounts of evidence because there isn't enough research hasn't been done, but there's certainly suggestive evidence that red flag laws make some sense and seem to, in a couple of states, have reduced some of the problems. One should recognize, too, is that the gun issue in the United States is not just one problem like mass shootings, but it really has to do with lots and lots of different problems. And so they include things like suicide, they include things like gang violence, they include things like intimate partner violence, they include mass public shootings, of course, and gun accidents. And what the mass shootings do, and have, at least have done in the other developed countries, is when there's a mass shooting, this attracts attention to gun issues, and so then people look at not just mass shootings, but at all the issues created by guns, the goods and the bad issues. And there are a lot of public health issues created by guns in the United States because we have so many guns and we allow virtually anybody to have easy access to very lethal weapons.
Talking with David Hemenway, a health policy professor from Harvard, about gun violence. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Brant now from Milwaukee. Hi, Brant.
Hello. Yes, I'd just like to comment on the professors. I agree that you know, there is gun violence in this country, and it's. But again, I also think that guns are not what the problem is. You can't take and make guns with rubber bullets, and you know, because criminals, they're going to find a weapon, no matter what. You know, if they want to commit a crime, that's what they're going to do. However, you know, there's something else that people don't realize is it, yes, we see all these gun crimes, but they don't realize how many lives are saved every year by guns, you know. And if you want to look at statistics, you need to see the more positive things about guns. However, it's tragic that you know, these things happen, but you can't really compare a firearm to a car, because a firearm is not designed like a car. A firearm is designed to shoot, you know. I guess what I'm trying to say is, yeah, you know, you have people who hunt.
And Brandt, I want to bring David into the conversation here. And one thing that sticks out, David, is that we can't hold back a perpetrator. Go ahead, David.
Oh, so a couple of things. One is this sort of notion that criminals will always get guns does not hold up in terms of when you look empirically. In countries where it's hard to get guns, very few criminals get guns. In states where it's hard to get guns, fewer criminals get guns. I live in Massachusetts, and we have a reasonable amount of crime, but our robberies are much less likely to involve guns. Why is that? Because guns are harder to get. When you make things harder for people to get, fewer people get them and use them. And one of the reasons that we do have a fair amount of gun violence in Massachusetts, even though we do great compared to the other states, is because we have neighboring states who have very weak laws. And so one of the ways our criminals get guns is going to these other states. And if these states had strong laws like we have in Massachusetts, we'd have even much, much less gun violence. The same way Canada criminals get their guns from the United States. Mexican criminals get their guns from the United States. In Jamaica, it's something like 75% to 80% of all guns used in crime come from three counties in Florida. And so there's sort of this notion that criminals always get guns turns out not to be correct. In terms of lives saved, we look both at lives saved and we look at lives lost. The same way you can, there's a lot of studies looking at a gun in the home. For the average person with a gun in the home, yes, it's possible that that gun could save a life, but it's incredibly unlikely, whereas it's much, much more likely that the gun will be used in a suicide or an accident or to kill a spouse. And so the evidence is overwhelming that guns in homes in the United States reduce the safety of people in homes. If they increase the safety of people in homes, people in public health would be advocating everyone should get a gun. But that's not what the evidence shows.
David, it's been two decades since Columbine. We see mass shootings becoming, it seems, more common. Might the frequency of these events be changing our behavior as a society? What do we know about the effects of the trauma?
Well, the effects of the trauma, it's the evidence, as I mentioned, is very clear. The effects of the trauma are bad. And it's the key thing, though, it's not just always an immediate effect. It's a long-run over-time effect, so it can affect people's mental and physical health 20 years later. Trauma is a terrible byproduct of gun violence. And so often in certain communities in the United States, there's so much gun violence that almost the whole community is traumatized. And as people say, hurt people hurt people. The notion that people who are traumatized are much more likely to act violently than people who aren't traumatized. So it is a terrible feedback effect.
Very quickly, Anne in Oak Creek, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. They make guns for quick, you know, for hunting, and then they make a little handgun for protection, and they make assault rifles for war, for mass killings and shootings. And there was a city in New Zealand that had a mass shooting. They banned the assault rifles, and as you know, pretty sure that helped tremendously. So I'm wondering why what's holding us here you know, this business, NRA or whatnot, that they can't, you know, they have to realize, hey, that's something not right. You know, we got to find new ways to make money. I know it's money, but is there anything else that's really keeping the assault rifles out there? Or
what is keeping assault rifles out there, David, very quickly here, less than a minute?
We basically have no federal laws and very few state laws saying what types of firearms can readily be bought.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us. David Hemenway is a professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health Studies and writes about injury prevention, including gun violence and firearms. Join us later today on Central Time as we look specifically at what firearm laws are on the books in Wisconsin and what future gun legislation looks like. That's after 4:45 on Central Time. Coming up, gun violence in public spaces. What does it do to our nation's psyche? Mass shooters in recent days have added new trauma to the sense of safety and communal life. Do the mass shootings alter your willingness to go to public events? Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Back after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're continuing to talk about gun violence on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The shootings over the weekend in El Paso and Dayton were the 21st and 22nd mass killings of this year in the U.S. That's according to a database that tracks homicides where four or more people are killed, not including the offender. President Trump, in an address from the White House yesterday, focused on mental illness rather than stricter gun laws. We here at The Morning Show had planned to talk about the gun lobby this hour prior to the carnage over the weekend, and we decided to keep this conversation right where it is about the NRA because it is so much a part of the political fabric in the gun laws that surface and the ones that don't see the light of day. So what questions do you have about the National Rifle Association? Are you an NRA member? How do you feel about the group's positions? Join in 800-642-1234. Alex Yablon is a reporter at The Trace. That's a nonprofit news organization covering guns and gun violence. Alex, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So before we get to the NRA, let's look at the conversation you had with a Yale professor who studies the aftermath of attacks. What did you learn there about the public space?
So I spoke with Vita Bosch, who's a professor of sociology at Yale, who studies security and public space. And what we gain from public space that's sort of free and open, and what we lose when security kind of becomes the overriding value. So Vita has studied, public events going, such as the Olympics that are on a really massive scale, but we talk about things like the Gilroy Garlic Festival and just the other weekend and the shooting in Brownsville, Brooklyn, and then I was getting ready to publish that paper, that interview, when two more mass shootings happened this past weekend. And basically what we talked about is the way that, when there's a horrible attack like this in public, there's enormous pressure on the government and on police and, business owners who may have, like in the case of Walmart, where their businesses may have been the site of a mass shooting, to make sure that this never happens again. That means that they increase the amount of surveillance. They'll make it harder to get in and out. They'll probably have more armed security or more aggressive police presence. And that, has a really constricting effect on the members of the public who use that space. It makes people feel a lot less spontaneous and comfortable. It makes it a lot more just logistically difficult to interact with, your fellow citizens.
And the professor can measure that? Like, we know that happens?
It's based on just looking at what happens when, you have to hand over your ID to get into a concert. You have to get patted down to get into a concert. It takes more time. Fewer people will show up to events than they have in the past when security is not quite as tight.
So moving to the NRA, the gun rights organization, has seen a somewhat rocky year with state investigations. There's been infighting. Last week, we learned three members of the NRA's leadership board resigned. What do we know about those resignations?
The three people who resigned are Esther Schneider, Timothy Knight, and Sean Maloney. They're part of a group within the NRA board that has called for some audits and some transparency and some reforms and possibly even leadership changes following some investigations by one of my colleagues, Mike Spees, who worked with me for 4 years. He just left for a new job, into high-level corruption and self-dealing and financial mismanagement at the NRA. The NRA had an exceedingly cozy relationship with its largest vendor, which is an ad company called Ackerman McQueen. It's basically kind of impossible to say where the NRA ended and this marketing and PR firm Ackerman McQueen began. A lot of the things that we think of as being the NRA, most notably NRA TV, which produced a lot of these sort of well-known personalities like Dana Lash, who was the woman in the Clench Fist of Truth ad attack in the New York Times. They were actually employees of this company, Ackerman McQueen, who appeared in videos on the NRA's behalf. And so basically, members of the board who felt that there was a lot of sort of conflicts of interest in this relationship, that the leadership was kind of using this relationship to enrich themselves, notably the ad company Ackerman billed the NRA for hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of luxury suits that it bought for Wayne LaPierre, and also for tens of thousands of dollars in luxury travel on private jets to the Bahamas and to Europe.
And Alex, corruption, that's a pretty loaded word right there. What specifically is corrupt?
So it's a very basic rule of business that, you have to manage conflicts of interest. You know, when you have an outside vendor like this company Ackerman, you don't have them on the inside of your company making decisions about how much they're going to get paid. And, you know, what happened was, like in the case of Wayne LaPierre and his suits and his travel, he used the fact that, you know, no one was auditing the billing statements from Ackerman McQueen to basically enrich himself. He knew that if, he had Ackerman McQueen buy him all of these luxury suits, which is completely unheard of in the nonprofit world, they would just be able to bill the NRA for it. And so then you also had examples of people who had worked for Ackerman McQueen, who were then hired by the NRA, who then gave business to other third-party vendors in which they had an ownership stake. So, you know, they had a clear conflict of interest there. Basically, they were giving the NRA's money to outside companies in which they stood to profit.
We're talking about the NRA with Alex Yablon. He's a reporter at The Trace who's been writing about the National Gun Rights Organization. What questions do you have about the NRA? Are you an NRA member? What do you think about the organization's legal or leadership battles? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Alex, is the NRA in dire financial straits right now? What do its financials look like?
Yeah, so it is. The organization kind of broke the bank in 2016 to back Donald Trump and Republicans. And it was a good political bet. You know, they spent more than any other outside interest group on behalf of Donald Trump and congressional Republicans. And you know, we know how the 2016 election turned out. Despite opinion polls showing that Donald Trump was unpopular, he still won. And Republicans kept control of the House and Senate, the House at least until 2018. But then they were kind of spent, and they couldn't afford to make much of an effort on behalf of congressional Republicans in the 2018 midterms. And they were outspent by gun control groups for the first time ever, which is just unheard of. They've also had to cut down on sort of very basic stuff at the office. You know, as one of my colleagues reported, they notoriously stopped having free coffee in the office. But more seriously, they, you know, they froze pension payments, and they've had to dip into funds for their they have a separate foundation, a grant making foundation, which they've had to use to fund the sort of day to day operations.
So the NRA's board, though, has 76 members. What is the board's role in day to day operations, and as it looks at these financials, and what is its relationship with the CEO, Wayne LaPierre?
Right. So the board of any nonprofit is basically supposed to make sure that the paid employees are doing their job, are, you know, acting in the best interests of the organization, especially in a fiduciary respect. You know, they're keeping the organization on sound financial footing and are prioritizing the mission and not sort of spending money on things that are sort of far afield from the mission. The NRA's board has not really done that. They have not sort of scrutinized the spending that that staff members like Wayne LaPierre have been undertaking over the last, you know, few decades that he's been in office. So when some board members sort of raised red flags when reports started coming out about the way that the money was being spent, they were stonewalled. Oliver North, who was the president of the board, which is largely a ceremonial position, when he started reading reports on our website and others, he started asking Wayne LaPierre for, you know, documentation of why they were spending so much money on this ad for Ackerman McQueen. And Wayne LaPierre just, you know, flatly refused to give him this documentation, which is pretty outrageous. You know, the board is supposed to have access to all the financial information of a given, you know, nonprofit or company.
Talking with Alex Yablon, who is a reporter at The Trace. We're looking at the National Rifle Association, and The Trace is focused on gun-related news in the U.S. Are you an NRA member? What questions or opinions do you have about the NRA? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about gun issues on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The NRA statement following the weekend mass shootings expressed sympathy for the victims, reiterated its stance of being committed to the safe and lawful use of firearms by those exercising their Second Amendment freedoms. Here is CEO Wayne LaPierre talking to the group's members meeting in Indianapolis back in May.
Those who oppose the NRA, and you know who they are, I don't have to tell you. I mean, you shake your head every day when they do it. They will stop at nothing to bring us down. In fact, the challenges that the National Rifle Association and all of us face right now are unprecedented.
What do you think about the NRA? Do you support the group's positions and its methods? Are you an NRA member or donor? Join in at 800-642-1234. Alex Yablon stays with us. He's a reporter at The Trace who's been writing about the NRA. Let's go to the phones now. Dwayne joining us from Wausau. Good morning, Dwayne.
Good morning, Kate.
Go ahead.
When I was going through scouting in the 70s, early 70s, we'd go to Boy Scout camp, and they, most Boy Scout camps had rifle ranges and you'd shoot single-shot 22 rifles. And the NRA was a big supporter of these programs. I imagine they helped, you know, supplement the chance with the 22s. And but you joined the NRA before you left camp that week, and they did teach safety first, and it was all single shot 22s, and you know, and then now it morphs into these rifles that, you know, are the 30-40 hundred round magazines. And you know, back in 1791, when the Second Amendment was passed, and I had to look that up because I didn't know, it took 20 seconds to 30 seconds to historically load a ball and musket. So, you know, people forget that it's just so different now with these weapons, and the NRA is supporting, you know, they don't want any control on any type of weapons. And when we started, it was a single shot 22, you know, pull the bolt back, you put a little shell in. And
yeah, Dwayne, it's interesting you bring up your scouting, because I'm wondering, Alex, is the NRA involved in youth programs today?
Yes, it is. It's definitely still the number one backer of youth, you know, marksmanship programs and gun safety programs. But the thing is that in recent years, the amount of money that is sort of spent on that core message of, you know, familiarizing Americans with the basics of firearm training and safety is now dwarfed by the amount that it spends on, or at least until this recent scandal broke, the amount that it spends on this sort of aggressive political marketing and branding. So it definitely still backs it, but it sort of has moved. It's no longer central to its mission.
Well, last month, after a couple years of state investigations and lawsuits, the NRA stopped offering self-defense insurance called Carry Guard. What can you tell us about that insurance and why it was shut down?
Carry Guard is basically legal insurance for gun owners in case they shoot someone in self-defense. Some people called it murder insurance. Basically, Carry Guard provided coverage for gun owners that would cover either legal defense costs in a criminal case or liability in a civil case. The thing is that when they put this together, they didn't realize that it was illegal in certain states, in particular New York, which is really important because New York has an outsized role in regulating insurance nationally, because so many large insurance companies and financial services companies are based there. Also, the NRA did not have a license to market this insurance themselves in New York or many other states. The state financial services regulators in New York started an investigation. They imposed a consent decree on the companies that were working with the NRA, basically saying you can finish out your contract with the NRA, but after that you're banned from ever doing business with the gun group, and imposed you know, millions of dollars of fines on them. Incidentally, not that many people really signed up for it in the first place. According to legal documents, fewer than 700 New Yorkers, and that's in a state with a population of tens of millions, had actually signed up for Carry Guard. So it was not much of a success. Even before regulators started scrutinizing it.
Let's bring in another call. Leslie joining us from Libertyville, Illinois. Hi, Leslie.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead, Leslie.
Yes, so I am a registered independent voter, and I've become familiar with the NRA over the last four decades of my life. And I see both sides of the issue here, and obviously it's because we're so polarized and divided that things aren't getting done with the NRA, I think. I think two elements that the NRA have going for it are capturing people's fear and defensiveness, and
underscoring that people are going to be losing their control over, well, as your callers alluded to before, their Second Right Amendment, their Second Amendment, rather. And I think that that needs to be considered. And I think it needs to be considered that that research is very important and needs to be presented in a way that everybody can understand. And people need to be encouraged to look at that research and realize this isn't a matter of taking away their control for defending themselves. And it's not taking away their right. This is making the country safer for everybody based on sound evidence. And that would require effort on everybody's part. I think people on both sides need to have a gentler approach. And I know that's difficult with the NRA. It's a very frustrating time.
Well, let's bring in Alex now. That, you know, Leslie saying losing control of freedoms, that really cuts deep.
Yeah, it's a very powerful message that the NRA bombards its members with all the time. You know, that people who want to change gun laws, they aren't motivated. You know, if you go to an NRA annual meeting, as I have a couple times, when Wayne LaPierre addresses the party faithful, he really stresses that the people on the other side of this debate don't just have a kind of honest difference of opinion about, you know, what would sort of make the country safer. It's that they actually sort of hate, you know, the sort of the freedom that gun ownership allows, and that gun control is sort of like the thin end of the wedge that's going to separate these people from their basic sort of God-given American rights. And, you know, on the other side, I don't think that advocates of gun law reform always do a great job of sort of trying to empathize with gun owners, the vast majority of whom are totally law-abiding. And, you know, many people who own dozens of guns never do anything wrong with them.
So, Alex, I want to be, because we're running short on time, could the NRA's organizational challenges that you've outlined throughout this conversation, could they affect its political influence?
Yes, absolutely. There was an article in Politico within the last few weeks about Republican operatives who are getting really nervous about what the NRA's sort of troubles mean for the 2020 presidential and congressional elections. You know, the Republican Party in the past decade or so has come to rely really heavily on the NRA to turn out its members, because there's probably not, you know, another organization with such a well-organized and motivated grassroots that turns out some elections. And if they are in such poor shape, and if the leadership is so divided, it's not clear how they're going to be effective at turning out their supporters for Republicans in the next election.
Alex, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Alex Yablon is a reporter at The Trace, a nonprofit news organization covering gun violence. Earlier, we spoke with David Hemenway, a health policy professor at Harvard. Stay with us for On Point after 9. On Point examines the criticism of President Trump's rhetoric after racism and white supremacy emerge as a focus in the aftermath of the weekend massacres. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.